Welcome to the Hacktivist Podcast, conversations that matter.
And welcome to another episode of the Hacktivist Podcast. True to our recent themes, we'll be talking to friends and activists in the humanist community. So today I have
Eugene Akono.
Eugene is a friend and a fellow humanist. As usual, my name is Michael. So Eugene, let's just dive right into it. You have a history living in Accra, right?
Yes, that's okay.
Do you have a history predating you living in Accra, or you were born and raised here?
My parents moved to Accra like way before I was born, so I've always lived in Accra.
Okay. Yeah. And where did your parents come from?
That's Odumase Krobo, somewhere in the Eastern region.
Somewhere in the Eastern region?
Yeah.
Oh, so it means you speak Krobo?
Precisely.
Oh, awesome. And where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Adenta.
All your formative years were in Adenta?
Yeah, so I find myself in the lucky position of being one of those people where I had a lot of stability in my life. In terms of where I was raised, and I didn't move around a lot. My parents didn't move around a lot, so I spent all my formative years in Adenta.
So means you schooled in Adenta, everything in Adenta?
Yeah.
Okay. How was primary school life for you like?
So primary school was, I don't think I have very good memories of primary school. Largely because, I was the only kid in the class, so I usually was the only kid in the class who couldn't read, so. That was a bit tough for me.
You couldn't read growing up?
Yeah. So I struggled a lot with reading when I was very young. So
okay.
It was something I had to shake off somewhere. I don't know. Getting to GSS1 was really hard. Yeah.
And was there any reason for that?
If you ask my mom, she say she prayed for me then. God opened my mind, as she likes to put it. But looking back at the whole experience, I still find remnants of the reason why I couldn't read from an early age, and I think it largely has to do with I would say I don't have a very good memory.
Okay.
And words are not something I easily gravitate to, so I usually gravitate towards pictures and stuff like that. So if if my learning has to do with a lot of wordy stuff, like turn to page 3, second paragraph, I'm already lost as to what the teacher is saying. I mean, those were very difficult challenges. It's later on, so most of the time during those periods, I used to do a lot of molding clays and artistic work and all that kind of stuff. And I caught on to a trick where I could encode the knowledge in a picture. Since then, I was able to make some progress.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask was whether you naturally caught on to that trick, or somebody taught you that trick.
It was, I think, a great deal of trial and error. Actually, I was pushed towards an ultimatum because I had moved to a new school somewhere in Medina, and they lashed like hell.
Wow.
And
I mean,
I came from, but before then, I came from a Montessori school where the rules were a bit more relaxed. There wasn't a lot of corporal punishment. You didn't have to face all of those challenges. So, having been in that situation, and then remember driving school every morning, I mean, I had to find out a way of solving that problem. Fortunately, I stumbled onto the right trick, that is to use what I best knew to encode the information. Yeah.
Basically pictures.
Yes, precisely.
Do you feel like things could have been different in terms of the Montessori school if they had a more targeted approach to try and understand how you understand things?
Yes.
It would have been better?
Yes, I think in hindsight, yes, I think the proprietor had a lot of the skills, the educational understanding that every kid comes with each their own special needs. I'm sure she would have been able to leverage on that to help struggling kids in the class, because in that period I was actually staying behind after school, and then they would take me through reading classes, and it was terrible. It was terrible. Yeah. Nothing stuck.
And it wasn't really helping, was it?
It wasn't. It only made me more, how do you call it, feel like there was something wrong with me. Because yeah. everyone would go after class and be playing, and yeah. I'd be left with the preparator who was trying to teach me how to spell a word or the other, or read a page. Or
using conventional methods.
Yes, using highly conventional methods.
Yeah.
It didn't help.
I see that happen a lot of times. And you see a lot of kids out there who feel stupid when it's not them. Like I always say, it's never the student. People do not want to feel stupid. People do not want to be stupid. Like, especially kids, they do not want, they, that feeling is, it sucks. So it's always has to do with finding ways to reach the kids. And you never know, maybe it could be through music, it could be through pictures. Some kids will learn math better if you just put it in a song. You never know. So I hope teachers out there, I don't know whether it's part of their training or they're just being taught conventional methods, because the variations in children is as vast as the variations in biology. So every kid comes with their own, like,
yeah, I mean,
different manual for everybody. So.
Exactly. I mean, so yeah, it makes me, given that experience, I more readily understand kids with reading difficulties and challenges and those things, or even general understanding with new concepts, new ideas and stuff like that. Then, well, yeah, basically. So, I think these are real challenges that we should look into. I think as a broader society. You know?
Yeah, because I have a boss who has a master's. He's super smart, but he's dyslexic.
Welcome to the world.
but he has a master's. And what helps is that he did his school in Ghana. So the school system outside there recognized that, oh, okay, this kid has dyslexia and we need to accommodate for him.
Precisely. I think these recognitions are very necessary if one is to make progress with the kids, and to, if we are to allow more kids into the classroom without saying you are either stupid or retarded, or we should pay more attention to the peculiarities of various learning disabilities or as it were various challenges. So yeah, I mean,
okay. Family life, like, were you alone? Did you have siblings?
Okay, so family life, I was the first of three kids. So I kind of developed a sense of relative responsibility in terms of, like, in relation to my siblings, actually. So I was raised in a household of let's say a very devout Christian, that's my my mom, and then somewhat relaxed Christian who was more based in practicalities of stuff, that's my dad. And family life was a bit turbulent because this were two parents. My parents were always going at it, a lot of issues with more finances, infidelity, and a whole lot. So it wasn't the best of environments.
Yeah, average Ghanaian household.
Yes, precisely. I mean, I'm not unique in this regard. But I mean, my childhood, largely, I kind of survived it by ignoring a great many things. Wasn't paying attention to details, and fortunately, my poor memory helped me out when it comes to that. Yeah. So.
Yeah, you could compensate for.
Yeah, and I live in a compound house, so you can imagine the
the
pressures, external pressures.
Mm-hmm. How are your relationship with your siblings? When for instance, the last one came around, how did you receive him? Is it a him or a her?
It's a
him. It's a him. Okay. Yeah, it's three boys?
No. So two boys, one girl.
Okay.
Yeah.
Middle child is a girl.
Yes.
Wow. I would like to talk to her.
I mean, she's an interesting character in her own right. Now, so, you know, I mean, I remember the first time I seen my younger brother, which was my mom had she was gone for a day or two. All I remember is that, again, my memory doesn't help me, but the only recollections I have is she coming back home in a taxi and she holding something in a bundle, white bundle, and then that's what I remember. Then the second memory is that this bundle is on the bed, and then there's some cute looking creature in it. That was my memory.
How old were you then?
So I think I should be around 7.
Around 7, okay. Okay, not bad, not bad. Well, you have a good memory for somebody that doesn't have a good memory.
Well, I think things that have an emotional charge to stay longer.
That's true. So, in discovering that you can actually read and that you weren't stupid in junior high, right? And discovering the trick of using pictures, right? Did that open a new world for you?
Yes. I mean, there are a few memories I have about the early stages of like call it my enlightenment, which were one of them being on my way back home from school. I was reading a book, a science book. I've forgotten the name now. It has something about Nyan Sapo. Forgotten the name now. It's called Nyan Sapo or something like that. And then on reading it, I was reading about the states of matter and how they can be changed from maybe solid to liquid. And that was the first time I met the atomic theory. And I read this guy's mind, and nobody was saying I was reading atomic theory, but how if it's all compacted together, it's really solid and things don't jiggle around, and it's solid. And when it's liquid, things are moving about freely. And when it's, it was breathtaking when I first read the idea. And I think it stuck with me throughout. Another thing to remember vividly was being very ill and suffering from bronchitis, so I couldn't go to school. I was on my sick bed, and for some reason I was trying to understand the mesuration formulas for why solid had the formula it does, why cube has a formula it does, and I stumbled on various neat tricks to encode the formulas, because there were many and I didn't see how a formula is related to a shape. And gradually I worked my way through it, and those were some of the things about the early
stages. I guess you kind of kept yourself, so you had a lot of time to do like a lot of thought experiments.
Yes. I mean, there was a lot of sitting down and wondering how this would play out. I remember on some moving occasions struggling with a math problem and then thinking about how it was going to work out and still not being able to do it, and then having a serious migraine. And then going to bed afterwards, and then waking up a few hours later with a solution. And that was my first experience with that. So, it was interesting.
So, did the bronchitis carry on through?
No. So, I mean, shortly after I recovered, my mom was sick again because of prayers. But then it went away. But it was a very scary moment in my childhood where there was a real concern about whether I would make it or not. But it lasted for longer than anybody thought it would. And none of the conventional medications were actually helping. But I've not suffered ever since from any lung issue or vaguely associated illness.
I could relate to what you're saying. And whenever I hear the phrase conventional medicine couldn't solve it, I always feel like, the doctors couldn't figure it out because they were not that smart. And I say this because I've also gone through the same thing. I've almost died more than once. And each time, it will take either a junior doctor or an extremely curious older doctor to ask the right questions. Because I've been misdiagnosed more than once.
I would not be surprised. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, especially like with the older doctors. I had a huge problem with them, so I'm a very disrespectful patient nowadays. It's like, because I feel like they've tried to kill me more than once.
They have had too many shots at this.
They just go with the standard diagnosis.
Yeah.
And I get them, Occam's razor, like, when you hear who's, think what horse is not zebra. But then in a case where you actually are thinking horses, and then
more evidence coming that it's not horses
because the medication isn't working. Whatever procedure you have for that particular diagnosis is not working, you should then start to consider whether they are zebras really out there or not. I've been misdiagnosed twice with malaria instead of typhoid.
Yeah. My brother tells me that seems to be a regular thing.
It's an extremely regular thing.
And
I hope that if there are some doctors listening, they will understand that they don't know everything.
Yes.
And they should continually be curious, continually think outside the box. And not everything is malaria.
Precisely, I mean, that goes without saying.
I know. So, senior high, what school did you get into?
Yeah, so senior high, because it took me a mighty long time to catch on to what most kids had already caught on,
mm-hmm.
reading, math, the usuals. I wanted to play safe when it came to senior high, so mm-hmm. I took a school that my elder brother himself had attended, which is Bishop Emmanuel.
Your elder brother?
Actually, technically, he's my cousin.
Cousin, oh, okay.
But he stayed with us ever since we were young, so I like to think of him fondly as my elder brother.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's played that role many occasions in my life, actually. So I chose his school to do science,
mm-hmm.
With a funny idea that should there be any issues with my grade, he might be able to persuade the headmaster, mm-hmm. on the basis that he's an old boy.
Yeah.
So yeah, so I got into Bishopman to do science.
To do science. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And did you like it?
Yeah, I did, but not because of the teachers per se, but because I really wanted to do science. And then mm-hmm. it provided me with a wonderful excuse to spend long hours reading stuff, mm-hmm. and learning a great deal about it. But not because I had wonderful teachers, far from it.
Mm. So there are no teachers from maybe junior or senior high who you would think had any
profound
influence on your curiosity or any of that?
My curiosity is rather, should I say, very innate, in the sense that I'm introverted,
mm-hmm.
so I spend a great deal of time thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that too long, I mean, you start to wonder what the great many things are doing.
Yeah.
So, as a child, I used to watch a lot of the Expedition to Animal Kingdom. So, I was fascinated with the biological world. And I, rather cruelly, I used to catch a lot of frogs in my neighborhood and dissect them to see what was that.
Yeah,
dry them up and find out how the bones are connected.
Well, I didn't really... I just used to catch them then try and open them up, and I didn't really want to kill them. I just like the fact that when you catch them, their defense mechanism was just glued up.
Yeah.
It's it was so funny. Like, what are you trying to do? Become a ball?
And not just that, they also have this
Secretions. Oh my god, yeah.
Very bitter. I've tasted it before.
Why did you do that?
I don't know why I did it, but I mean, I was young and I didn't know that maybe I could be taking some neurotoxins. But I think I tasted it on a good many occasions just to see what
it tasted like. Oh my god, that's
disgusting.
Remind
myself. So, yeah, so I would proceed to cut them up, study them carefully, look at their skin, the eyes, wonder how they ticked, cut them up. See what the skeletons look like. Yeah, so I mean, I was rather interested in the biological world. Then, so in terms of the teacher, there was one math teacher in JSS who scared the living daylight out of me. He was very rote memorization, I guess, because he had recourse to a very powerful memory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's even been on the What Do You Know show on a couple of occasions. Emmanuel Achu. So I mean, this guy could remember everything in an encyclopedia.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but he had a good memory. So I mean, he was the one who made us understand that there's a world larger than the syllabus, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the type of individual to approach or to nurture curiosity in any real sense of the word. His approach to math was more like a rigid set of rules you had to follow to get to the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean,
rather than it's fluid.
Yes, it's fluid. Yeah. So, which was something I had discovered later after I'd completed. But yeah, so if there's anything like a vague influence, I mean,
that as a person,
I would say.
Yeah, I mean, influence could isn't essentially supposed to be positive. Because I've had some negative experiences that
I've been in the right direction.
Yeah, that shaped the way I think. So yeah, it's a good influence, even though it's the wrong kind of influence. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in senior high, right, did Bishop Ehman offer you, like, because then you had discovered books, you've discovered reading, you've discovered that there's a whole new world undiscovered, and being introverted means you had more time to discover those. Did Bishop Ehman offer you, like, a world of books?
Okay, so Bishop Ehman, it was funny because, well, there was a library, but people didn't really go there.
Mm-hmm.
And you stand the risk of sticking out like a sore thumb. Right? Mm-hmm. So you don't want us to go to the library. But then I got books. I mean, either I bought from a neighbor who was doing physics before going to school, the physics class, a whole lot of other books, but not necessarily because I went to the library.
Mm-hmm.
The library, it was only when I started stumbling onto ideas like calculus, which I thought was the most amazing thing ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I struggled in first year in secondary school to learn it by myself. So I finished learning calculus by the end of the first. Then,
you mean calculus one or calculus one?
The entire
two, three?
Thing.
Then, wow.
I was enthralled by it. I just wanted to understand what it meant, because in all the science books I was reading by then, they kept saying this is rather breathtaking. It gives you an insight into almost every sort of problem, like
everything that has to do with change.
Yes, everything that has to do with change. Yeah. But a little caveat that I still didn't understand limits by then, so which means my understanding was a bit more flaky. It took me a while to understand limits, therefore I didn't understand the heart of calculus very well. Then another thing,
aren't you supposed to learn limits? Aren't you supposed to understand limits before you can even understand integration?
Yes, yes. But all of calculus, both the first half, that's the differential half, and then the integration half, are united by the single idea of limits.
Yeah.
So at the heart of calculus is understanding limits and how you take an infinite set, they approach a certain value.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But I wasn't armed with that component, because the deep understanding of you can say limit out, but to understand it means you have to have a powerful understanding of the Cauchy definition of limits, which came in university.
Yeah.
But the vague sense of it, not the formal routine one, I didn't
understand. You know the funny thing is, I didn't understand the Cauchy.
Ah, well, I
didn't, because then again, it speaks to the problem we have in engineering. We'll come to that. You're an engineer.
Yeah.
But we'll come to that. Throughout senior high, introvert, reading books and all of that. Beautiful. Any influences in uni? Again, you said, even though you said your teachers were a great influence.
No, I don't think I had much of an influence.
Was there any particular book author who other part?
Okay, I think Isaac Asimov helped a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, so reading Isaac Asimov, his book on life and energy, that was the first time I understood that the inanimate world and the animate world are not entirely different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a thin line, an extremely thin line. Yeah. Okay. So Isaac Asimov became your first kind of scientific hero. Not Isaac Newton.
No.
Asimov.
Asimov became, because I learned a great deal from Asimov, but Newton I only worshipped from a small boy trying to understand general relativity.
Trying to understand motions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Everybody who comes to the table of science, right? Because the world is so dynamic, everything is in motion, right?
Yeah.
You kind of fall in love with Newton first. Like, not even Galileo, even though he is the shoulder on which Newton stood. But Newton's understanding was so beautiful. Like, the way he framed everything, it almost feels like, why didn't you think of it?
Yeah, precisely. I remember reading about universal theory of gravity for the first time. I was like, wow, I could have come up with this.
Yeah, it makes you feel like, oh, you could have come up with it. This doesn't seem like it took a genius to figure it out. It looked like it was just there waiting for anybody to just stumble on it. Okay, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and then when we come back, we'll talk about life in the university. And then we'll have a bit more talk about your various other influences.
This is the Hacktivist Podcast. Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast.
Welcome back to the Hacktivist Podcast. I have been in conversation with Eugene. By the way, it's flu season, so please take the necessary precaution. We are here drinking some hot tea, trying to recover from bouts of the flu. So let's move straight to the uni. You found yourself in the same uni I did because, again, you were interested in the sciences, you were interested in
engineering. So where else for 30 years if not in
the Kwame Nkrumah University? I just want to know, because I found it fascinating that you had a love for biology growing up. And I know you've not lost that love, but what led you to engineering?
Okay, so, I mean, engineering was more of one, I'd wanted to study something along the pure sciences. Mm-hmm. But then I was repeatedly reminded that, or I was repeatedly warned that I might not find a job after studying something as far removed from the everyday concerns like physics or chemistry or any of those things. Mm-hmm. Then I toiled around with the idea of mechanical engineering for a while. Mm-hmm. Because I kind of was crazy about engines. Mm-hmm. At a certain phase in my life. Eventually, I settled on telecommunications because I thought it was, well, the next hot thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it wasn't, your decision had nothing to do with what you actually wanted to study?
No.
And not to do with your chances of getting employed?
Yeah. I mean, those are the things that informed my final decision. I mean, but I'd always had this love for the sciences. It's always been with me, and in many ways, science is kind of like my first love in the sense that it helped me cope as a child, because I could always get lost in some obscure description about stars or the universe or some interesting stuff that I didn't have a remote connection to. So it was in a sense a form of escape. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, escapism is not a bad thing. It's what has fueled most of the world's inventions. Mm-hmm. So you found yourself doing telecoms engineering, right? Still no particular human influence in academia?
No particular, as in someone within the field that I admired?
Yes, that was
in tech.
Okay. At least I had one. I don't know whether you met him before he left, Dr. Anson, and then Professor Jokoto. Okay. These were inspirational people.
But Jokoto was in which department?
Strength, materials.
Okay, fine, I mean, okay, I see what you're going after, but in my experience, I wasn't quite impressed by the guys in the electrical and telecommunications department. Not particularly, because for one thing, I expected a more hands-on approach to a great many of the things we were learning. And the great disillusionment in tech came from the fact that as the courses progressed, I didn't find myself increasingly capable of a more practical demonstration of ideas I had learned. That's the great letdown for me. Mm-hmm. In terms of people who impressed me, it happened once in one class, and it was actually in an engineering math class. And it was one reverend, I've forgotten his name now, but he came up with a rather impressive way of integrating a rather complex integrand. Mm-hmm. And then use a complex number approach to it, and I found it breathtaking. And he's the only one I wanted to talk to after the class, but I mean, I didn't have a lot of lectures or that I wanted to talk to after class.
Oh, okay. You didn't have any lecture that can like that gives rousing speeches about the importance of your course or the many like the parallels between what you're studying and life itself?
No.
Wow, then your department had must have been
extreme. I mean, for a group,
extreme letdown.
Extreme. I think I got so disappointed that I stopped going for classes at some point, because I felt if all you wanted me to do is regurgitate what's in the handout nothing other than that. I could do that without coming to,
class.
And the other letdown too was, I also felt that the whole scheme of testing wasn't a real wish on the part of the lecturer to evaluate comprehension, but rather memorization. So that was also a great letdown. So I started learning halfway to the end of the course. I mean, in many ways, I took the wrong approach to a problem, you would say. But these were the experiences I faced.
And again, your experiences are not unique. But I found out, right, people from the mechanical engineering department, for instance, talk like you do, I feel like then it was their perception which was wrong, and not the department itself. Because we had people like Agbeko, who was taking us through lab tech, and we had a lot of inspirational moments with him. But a lot of people just saw it as him talking, rather than trying to look beyond and then see exactly what he was trying to imbibe in us, like the work ethic he was trying to imbibe in us, the fact that as engineers, we do not have rest periods. So whenever we can get it, like a few moments of rest, we have to rest, because when the job calls, it's a 24-hour-a-day calling. I got that from my group. The fact that all our efforts is actually to reduce work so that we can have more leisure. I got that from Anson.
Impressive. I mean, these are solid ideas I only learned after school.
Exactly. Yeah, so I'm saying maybe the analogies we missed a lot of the analogies in school, because him referencing, like, for instance, the idea of fluid dynamics, like the motion of fluids being the same as traffic flow, and then the design of runabouts and routes and traffic being the same as...
These are deep insights. These are deep insights.
What worries me is that a lot of the time, right, as students, we may not be able to draw the parallels between some of these insights and the realities of life.
Okay, so let me tell you a typical experience, or one of the experiences I had. So I was in telecommunications, right? I went to the electrical and electronic department, right? So the thinking was I was going to take a certain set of courses that were going to give me an insight into how the laptop machine I was using worked. And I think I never caught on to how it worked. And that was one of my letdowns. I think I found out the reason why I didn't catch on. Largely because we're buried in a great deal of details about how this particular transistor works, about how this particular voltage is measured, and a great deal of details that made it hard for me to, as it were, step out and see the whole architecture.
Yeah, the big picture.
Yeah, the big picture of the whole thing we're doing. And those were, I couldn't connect a great deal of the ideas. Because you can see the big picture, you don't know what information theory has to do with adequate communications or microprocessors or transistors. So these are courses you took. But I couldn't really make the connection.
And do you know the thing is, I still don't blame students. Like, no matter what happens, right, I don't blame. It wasn't your job to see the connections. It was somebody else's job to prompt you to those connections. Right, so for instance, right, the engineering maths, right, it was not your job to see how the engineering maths you were learning in first year was connecting the dots in something that you are going to apply in the second year. It was the job of somebody else to prompt you, to push you towards the idea that, look, this is what is going to be applied here in this practical sense. Right, to just guide you somehow that, okay, or if you want more information, look in this direction. And somebody did this experiment in this. So it wasn't essentially our job. And the letdown I had with the whole engineering course was the same thing, that the only reason why I connected so many ideas was I stayed after I became a teaching assistant. And there was no impending exam.
Yes. So you could take the time.
To actually connect the dots.
I think that's what happens to a great many kids. In my case, so after I completed, I was like, ah, so I did something about electronics, transistors, voltage, amplifiers, and all that. And I'll be hard pressed to explain how a computer works. So I
said, know how all the components work.
Yeah, just in bits, in pieces. And so I was like, okay, no, I need to find out how this works. Because I mean, computers are the heart of everything now. So luckily, I stumbled on a book called But How Do We Know? And it's largely about how to build a computer from ground up. So we're talking about how you get a transistor, how you put them together to form a logic gate, how you set up logic gates to form various logical functions, and then memory states, and then you can store information, retrieve them, execute computations on them, send them back. And then I got a deep understanding. But as I was reading the book, I was having various epiphanies, like, I've seen this before, I know about this, that kind of thing. And it kept going on till I reached the climax, halfway to the book, and said, okay, and task, now we build a computer. I'm like, wow. So this was a larger picture to the whole thing that I had not yet seen. So I mean, these are some of the shortcomings of my education. Someone could say, well, I could have studied harder, but I mean, the extra energy.
I don't think you could have, because look, I was in the upper echelon of like the smart students, right? And we didn't get it. like we were the ones that like the lecturers were looking up to,
this to save their face,
and we were not getting it. It was because we always like there was always one. We're always missing the bigger picture. We're always missing like the connections between everything. And also because my worst fear is this, the lecturers themselves were missing the bigger picture.
Yes, and that experience was terrible. I had that experience in two courses, one on signals and systems and the other one on electromagnetism.
Signals and systems?
Yes. So in electromagnetism...
A lady doctor?
No.
Okay, good. Because that woman messed me up.
One reverend. So in electromagnetism, these were the things we learned from secondary school. As in like induction, the law, Faraday's law of induction, the usual things about electricity and stuff. But they had been encoded in the new math that we are learning in engineering school as vector calculus.
Yeah.
Yes. So, and then it takes on a fluid dynamics sort of charge where we're talking about the electromagnetic field that under various alterations is generating another field according to what we call Maxwell's equation. So these were some of the things. And on every occasion where in class I tried to either get a deeper insight to the formulas by asking the lecturer a question, he shut it down with an answer that said, went something along the lines of, don't ask me this question, it is not important, follow what I'm saying. And that kind of kills the spirit in whatever you are doing, because you shouldn't. I feel like students don't have to take ideas like we got them from Mount Sinai and we have to enact them. But then they should ask, how does one come about this and what are some of the. So, I mean, those are the experiences. And every time I watched videos on YouTube, open courseware from other universities, I was always blown away and say, I did the same course and the lecturer didn't mention this or demonstrate this. And I mean, the thing was one letter after another letter. In many ways, you could say, I survived tech because before the letdowns, I did exceptionally well in my first year. Mm-hmm. So my grades just kept declining throughout, but
I mean,
it was high enough.
Same trajectory. The only way I could walk away with the first class was to do extremely well in my first year. Like first year was just, I was just a nerd. So I just did everything I could. And then after that, it's not that we were coasting, you know? I think it was more like, it was more like an ambivalence, like, okay, you know what, this is not going to change and there's nothing we can really do for it to change. Like, I sometimes feel like the more effort I put into a particular course area, the less marks I get.
So,
I might as well just chase the marks or just chase. So sometimes I was doing my own coursework instead of the actual coursework. I was just trying to understand how certain things work. And then accidentally, I remember in programming, right? I accidentally found shortcuts. But then that still got me lower marks because I wasn't reproducing same
what they wanted.
Stratagem that they had implemented. Like, this is coding. It's the end result that we really want. It's not
the internal of the object, the black box. how you implement.
It's how you implement it. But I still got my scores were lowered because I was finding shortcuts. It was the same thing when we were doing final element analysis, like trying to, you know, how final element analysis works. Like basically, you are coding from first principles.
Okay.
So you are looking at the structure and you are saying, oh, let's look at, instead of looking at structure, look like certain rules in the structure.
And what stress and strains they are.
Exactly. So you're analyzing
element by
element. Element by element. Okay. And it's basically metrics, like higher skills of metrics.
Okay. Amazing.
And I found an easier way, an easier approach, which actually would get, will run the program shorter. Because the normal approach, the program has to run longer.
Yeah.
I got, my marks got lower. And I was like,
I mean, this is the price you pay for innovation.
Yeah. So if innovation is being
stultified,
yeah, it didn't really make sense. So I really did not like academia. I really did not like university. That doesn't mean I wasn't doing well. It's just that I didn't like the environment.
The mechanic, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, good. So now we can talk about philosophy. Like, we understand your love for sciences. We understand the path, the journey that you were on that led you to become a telecoms engineer, a practicing telecoms engineer. What about philosophy? When did you start to stumble on certain philosophical works and thoughts? Like, what was your first one?
It'll be hard pressed to remember the first one. But, I mean, I had a bunch of people also in my neighborhood who picked up one or two things in philosophical thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear someone talk about Socrates and you hear someone talk about Aristotle. And,
mm-hmm.
Yes, but you just heard them in quotes or like being thrown around. I mean, but then what drew me to philosophy would be, in general, my love for science, because you have to have some philosophy of how you think fundamentally the world works. And in that pursuit, I came across people like David Hume.
Uh-huh.
He's
a philosophy of science guy.
Yes, yes, more about knowledge and epistemology.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what you can know, what you can't know, what you can be sure of, and all of that. And so. I mean, it was people like David Hume. I remember Bertrand Russell having a great deal of influence on me. Reading some of his works really blew my mind. Yeah. And later I fell in love with people like Karl Popper.
Mm-hmm.
And those were some of the key figures when it comes to philosophy. But my general take on philosophy, it will be more of a Lucretian sort of take on it, that there's nothing but atoms in the void, and that the world is not made up of different elemental parts, but a few elemental parts in different aggregations.
Yeah. So you have a more materialistic view of
the world. Yes, so I think, in a sense, the word materialistic doesn't mean I like money. Yes, I'm materialistic.
Yeah, it's like you think that it's stuff is all that we are made of.
Yes, yes, yes. And
okay.
Stuff and different arrangements.
Different arrangements of stuff is
make,
all that we are made of.
Yes, make all the beautiful things we see in the world. So that's my philosophical outlook on the world.
Mm-hmm.
I read a couple of books by Nkrumah expanding philosophical ideas, and they were quite influential. Yeah.
Mm. So basically, if you read Nkrumah, it means you stumbled on like Marxism, socialism, at quite an early age.
Yes, but I don't think they, one, either I understood it very well, or two, stuck with me. Yes, I must have, because you have to understand, I was operating within a very limited sphere. I didn't have a lot of access to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So it was what I got by accident. And then,
right,
then there was also the question of, have you properly understood what you've read?
Yeah.
Yes.
What was the first philosophical idea that really blew your mind, that were like, that changed your fundamental understanding of the universe? Was that the Lucretian idea?
The first philosophical idea. I don't think I do have something readily comes to mind, but if there's anything that blew my mind, then it is the feeling that there isn't a real distinction between right and wrong in sense that these are objective things in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was a big stretch for me to come to terms with.
Like, coming to terms with the relative, like, how relative it all is.
Yes. Yes.
Didn't the theory of relativity make you stumble on that?
No.
On the idea that it's all actually from, it all depended on your
preference.
Yeah, from your frame of reference.
Yeah, I mean, one can study relativity without it affecting his takes on morals. And for me, I took relativity on face value. That when it comes to things like clocks, length, they change with perspective, speeds, through natural frames. But I didn't necessarily think it would affect morals. I thought some of those things were exempted from the physical world to some degree. So I didn't necessarily apply it to that. It was only later that I started incorporating
the parallels between them all.
Yes.
Okay.
Started incorporating.
Interesting.
And I think one idea also that was, I wouldn't call it philosophical, but that everything evolves. I mean,
that was
a powerful idea, but when I heard it, I still didn't know the power of the idea.
Yeah.
It took me many years to actually find out how phenomenally powerful the idea is.
I mean, you know what is funny, right? If you stumble onto Darwin and Darwinian philosophy, it extends beyond biology.
Mm-hmm.
It extends actually even beyond science, beyond sociology.
Yes.
It's a religious, and I'm not using the word religious as in the conventional use of the word, the hijacked conventional use of the word, but it's a religious understanding that is bigger than yourself. Like there is something bigger than you. There are powers at play that are levels of magnitude away from your control.
Yes. I mean, Daniel Dennett calls the theory of evolution a universal asset. There's no container for the idea.
Exactly.
That corrodes through every single
idea. Exactly. Even into physics, which is funny because it should have been maybe thermodynamics somehow plays into the idea of evolution. Maybe the idea of entropy plays into the idea of encapsulates the idea of biodiversity. But that would be a stretch.
Yeah, that would be quite a long
stretch. That would be a stretch. We could make the argument, but we would need a bit more.
A stack of facts or slightly evidence to support that.
Exactly. Okay, so we've looked at those kinds of philosophies. Now, let's examine the current labels that you identify with. Do you identify with, say, humanism?
Oh yes, I do identify with humanism. Yes, largely humanism is the conception that that our problems can only be solved by the human intervention. That there isn't going to be anything like gods up there or any benign superpower that's going to take an interest. One, going to take an interest in our problems. And then two, is going to maybe make any active efforts to kind of help us solve that problem. To me, humanism is the recognition that we are human beings. And our progress is tied with every other human we share the planet with. And then what best we can actually do to facilitate flourishing as a way in terms of like creativity, expression, love, what have you, the human spirit to transcend our very primal instinct will be some of what I consider part of what it means to be a humanist or a humanist idea.
Okay, what other levels do you currently occupy?
Okay, so one other label I currently use is a fallibilist.
Mm-hmm. It's a long word.
Yes, very long word. Okay, so and then so let me talk a little bit about fallibilism. So, you know, I think truths are much more rare than people think.
Mm-hmm.
That to get an insight into what the world really is, which is the true foundations of how the world works, you have to iterate through a great many wrongs or a great many misconceptions. And on the basis of that, there's also the understanding that there have been a set of ideas that we originally thought were right. Mm-hmm. And with the influx of new information, we've come to understand that they're wrong. Now, liberalism is just a recognition of all that history. It's a recognition that people have made projections about what is right. And in the coming of more information, they've found out that that's wrong. So for liberalism, just recognize that we can't be sure of what we know. Mm-hmm. And that there isn't any utopian state like, oh, we know this for sure and we can't convince God of it. Mm-hmm. It's the conception that we are going to be infinitely ignorant and then we'll always be ignorant. That's what fallibilism is all about. That no idea is beyond criticism, no idea is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. That they have misconceptions about every idea you could, mm-hmm. you could have. Yeah. That's the idea.
Is that a synonym for agnosticism?
Oh no. I don't consider it. An agnostic is more of he's unsettled about maybe one or two sides of a conversation. Mm-hmm. A fallibilist can say, I agree that the evidence has stacked up on this end. He's not necessarily saying enough evidence will push me in the other direction. Mm-hmm. He's just saying, even with what we currently understand, it's not the whole story.
There's always more to the
there's
story.
There's always more to the to if no the truth if you is rare, then anybody who takes Karl Popper seriously understands the simple fact that you can only be sure you are wrong.
Yeah,
but that you are right, you can't
yeah,
be sure.
Yeah, that is true.
That's the only thing. You can only show that, okay, this is not the height of the building, mm-hmm. but to say, okay, but what is the real height of the building? That's a bit more difficult to say.
Yeah, I think most engineers, if you took your measurements, the metering courses that we did seriously, you would realize that the truth is extremely rare. And it's extremely relative.
Yes.
And that even in saying, oh, this is 1 meter, you should be able to back it, like, just understand that there is there's a degree of uncertainty attached to anything that we say.
All measurements.
Yeah, to all measurements. Now, if you can extend that idea logically, then it's all things.
Yes.
Okay. There's a degree of uncertainty to everything that we do. And maybe that's a nice outlook to life. But then, you know, being uncertain is a very uncomfortable feeling.
Yes, I think I must say this as well. What I mean by fallibilism doesn't necessarily mean I am in this floating sea where nothing is certain and all that. But it's to say, to have at the back of your mind that you can still act on what you currently do understand, mm-hmm. but that you should always apportion your confidence level to mm-hmm. the facts.
Yeah.
And that if new facts come to suggest that mm-hmm. otherwise, you should be able to have the confidence to say, fine, let's trade out. You would find out that in a very critical study of history, particularly let's take physics, mm-hmm. there have been a long history of we being sure about one thing or the other. Mm-hmm. You can say...
Like calories.
Well, calories didn't have a long day in the sun, but eventually it succumbed.
Wait, it's still being used.
I mean, in terms of like a metric measure, but
yeah.
the conception is of that heat is a fluid that moves from one point
yeah.
to another. No, I mean, we've replaced that with a kinetic theory mm-hmm. of heat. So, but yeah, so you see that consistently from physics, there's Newton, mm-hmm. then Einstein comes to dethrone him. Mm-hmm. Even Einstein gives birth to a child that he wants to kill in his infancy, which is quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. which is overthrowing both his contribution, earlier contribution, and Newton's contribution. Yeah. So you find out that to be sure is to really give up progress to some
yeah.
extent.
Yes.
But to act also requires some level of certainty about
yeah.
your actions. Either to enough to convince you to take that path. Yes.
Yeah.
But there should always be that recognition that
yeah.
You don't totally comprehend the situation.
Yeah. Basically, you are, like, to put it in mathematical terms, you are saying that we should always recognize boundary conditions of our thoughts.
Yes, precisely.
And also recognize the limits of our thoughts.
But all of these things are hard, but one should always have them at the back of their heads.
Mm-hmm.
I think we as a society, place a lot of premium on confidence. If someone tells you something and he seems rather confident
yeah.
about to say, maybe genetically you also hardwired to pursue leaders who are very confidently expound
yeah.
on one idea or the other. But we know all of this doesn't hold. In the long steady office leader. I've been one confident leader after another who has spouted one garbage idea after another garbage idea, and then all of them, in hindsight, we see we're all crap. Mm-hmm. But in the times in which these people were talking, they sounded like wonderful.
They knew exactly what they were talking about.
Yes, and it goes without saying that many generations from now, people will be appalled by the things we, yeah, we consider either the right thing or the right theory or the right conception of the world. But yes, I mean, we should always have that idea at the back of our mind.
That doubt is
essential for progress. All the time. So that's the underpinnings of the whole fallibilism idea. And then the other label I like to also use, which is optimism. Because in terms of philosophies, I didn't quite say this earlier, but I read too many pessimistic philosophers. Oh. People like Nietzsche.
This is the Hacktivist podcast. Particular.
Yeah, so
how are they pessimistic, really?
Yes, they people like...
Take Nietzsche, for instance. How is Nietzsche's understanding of the world pessimistic?
Nietzsche's understanding of the world is very pessimistic in the sense that he presents this rather gloomy world where it doesn't make much room for things like flourishing, love, and he saw the whole world as some competition, mm-hmm, about like good versus might versus mm-hmm. But in his extrapolation, it was all good and bad for all of us.
And isn't it? So let's interrogate this a bit, because I don't think Nietzsche, for instance, right, his outlook is as, I don't think like prophets of doom, in quotes, right, are being pessimistic, right? They are just presenting a reality upon which, unless we act, we are heading towards a particular doom. So it's not like... again, entropy. If we don't add energy to the system is going to devolve to chaos. So he's just presenting you with, okay, this is the trajectory on which we are going. Right? We have this optimistic idea that, oh, and again, it's because of history that always at the 11th hour, human ingenuity or like humanity always steps up to the plate and solves the problem. And because of that, we become extremely complacent. And so I feel like sometimes we should be optimistic about how pessimistic. I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm just saying.
Okay.
The prophets of doom may be right.
Okay, but in terms of prophets of doom may be right, I think there have been many occasions in history where people have always blown the siren that the world is about to end. The world is about to end. But if you ask me, I think they have been too early in ringing the siren and saying the world's about to end. In some occasions, their warnings have been helpful in the sense that they brought attention to grave problems that needed to be solved. But what people like Schopenhauer are people who looked at life from a very gloomy point, that it was always going to end bad for you. At the end, things were not going to take on an upward tilt. There wasn't that light at the end of the tunnel. To some extent, they paint the idea of consciousness as the greatest evolutionary mistake possible ever made.
Yeah.
In the sense that the creatures were now conscious of themselves, they were recognizing they were going to die, were going through things like suffering and stuff like that. I mean, so on reading people like that, I kind of felt like, the world takes on a very dark charge, if you get me. But lately, I've come to realize that the right attitude towards the future is that. What I mean by optimism is the understanding that all evils are due to insufficient knowledge.
Okay.
That's what I mean by optimism. It is not a way to prophesy the future, rather, but it's a way to explain failure. Mm-hmm. Which is to say that whenever we fail, the reason is that we didn't know enough in time. That's all optimism is saying. And then to also underpinning the idea is the fact that if you are to create knowledge, then you have to be actively trying to do that. Knowledge that's established in your mind, into your
lap.
You have to put an effort into doing it. So the whole optimistic charge is to say, whatever problem we face as individual society or the larger world, it is always because we didn't know enough. You get me? But it's not as if we are destined to fail. That this is only so far the human race will go.
Okay. Reverse engineer that thought.
Yeah.
We are destined to fail because we never know enough.
No, I don't think that's the case. I think there's always going to be this race between knowledge
and impending doom.
Yes, an impending doom. And then that is always going to be the state of the human condition. There has never been a state in human history, maybe unless you take the story of Adam and Eve overtly seriously, where there was a point where all was bliss and all was utopia. But if you look at the human history, there, we are always fighting an issue of there was a pending destruction, and then we were to find out how best to escape all of that. David Deutsch, in his book, The Beginning of Infinity, talks about the people who occupied Easter Island and how that civilization fell. And in his analysis, he tries to say the reason why they failed as a civilization, which was some island cut off somewhere in the Pacific, is to say that they did not have optimism. They didn't recognize the problems we're facing was an issue of knowledge.
Yeah.
And that if you do, I think, if you do make that admission, there's a great advantage, because now one can think about knowledge generation, which is, if you take the Darwinian approach to things, is variation and selection, variation and selection. That's how we actually make knowledge. All throughout, we vary things slightly
and then select,
and then select through it, and then before you know, we have a wonderful idea. Yeah. But if a society doesn't take part in it, or doesn't recognize, for example, like let's say all the many things that we used to consider as a given, that there will be farming, there will be plague, there will be pestilence, there will be earthquakes, and there will be all these problems. You used to think of, even in Ghana here, we take floods as a natural force, that is just regular. But if you do conceal the world as to say that the problem that we face is a problem of knowledge, then we can actively generate that knowledge and then use that knowledge fruitfully to solve problems. And then there's the even deeper thing, which is to say, if you consider all sets of physical transformations that are possible in the world, as in either to take a piece of sand and turn it into a microprocessor, or take some nitrogen in the air, convert it to fertilizer, or anything you can conceive of, the question is always an issue of knowledge.
Yeah.
And once human beings can bring the necessary knowledge to bear, they can solve all problems. Or I think yes, to be optimistic, yes, all problems.
Speaking of optimism, right? I just want your take on this, and then we can call it a day.
Yeah.
It's been extremely lovely talking to you.
Pleasure here. The same pleasure here.
The impending doom of an asteroid hitting us. Right. This has happened, what, twice?
Yes, I think twice.
At the very least.
But I mean, during the early stages of the Earth, I mean,
there was a lot of problems, but like maybe twice after biological life.
Oh yeah. But that's at the very least. But I think this happened on more occasions.
Now, the possibility of an existential threat.
Well, in terms of technology.
In terms of an asteroid, isn't that? That's an existential threat. Right. You will not exist, right? You would think that would be enough for us to push resources into getting knowledge on how to solve that particular problem, knowing that there's a possibility that this will happen. Why do you think, as a society, things like existential threats, like for instance, if from outer space asteroid belts, asteroids hitting us, maybe a solar event, then we can look at locally climate change, which humans are causing. You think that things that are existential, things that will just end the human race, the humans themselves will, in effect, push to find solutions to it. Why do you think that there's extremely slow progress on that end?
Well, that's a really tough one. On the issue of our recognition that we live in a solar system that has asteroids whose trajectories are not stable, and some can wander in our direction. I mean, these are problems that require a great deal of a public consensus that this is a real threat, and this is an issue that we all need to focus on. And if the general public doesn't see it as a real headache, I mean, consequently, they will not fund a lot of research into that direction. And this is something we are not doing very well. But there's also the fact that these are rare events. Mm-hmm. They are not events you can say would happen in maybe 100 years. You can't quite, but with the prolonging of the period, maybe 1,000 years, you could say.
You know, we didn't see the asteroid hit, the one that hit Russia. We didn't
Yes. We didn't see them.
Yeah. And if it had hit in, say, if it had hit in Accra,
yeah,
you know how good I would have died.
Yes, but I do get you, but again, it is like the story we tell about the frog where you dip it into hot water and it quickly jumps up. Then you put it down into water of room temperature and then you gently like crank up the temperature and it'll be there till it boils up. However apropos that story is, it does capture our attitudes in general. That we do not necessarily see impending danger. Even if it's staring us in the face. Even if what is making it pending is sheer probability that given enough time, this problem will be an inevitable problem.
Yeah.
We will still look at it as a highly relevant event till it kind of strikes. But I don't see anybody, I see a couple of scientists championing the idea, but I think on the larger population, it's a non-event, it's a non-perception.
Okay, so let's remove ourselves from like, extremely, let's not even extremely, like improbable events, right? And let's come to extremely probable events like Ebola, for instance,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We first learned about Ebola in the 80s. It was the 70s.
It was the 80s.
It's hemorrhaging fever. Extremely deadly, right? The people it was affecting didn't bother to study it.
No, I mean, definitely not.
Okay, now it came back, it has come back like 3 times already. It came back 5 years ago, because I got a reminder on it. 5 years ago to 3 days ago. And when it came back 5 years ago, right, the people in the Western Hemisphere felt like, no, this is something that, because we are now in a global village, can cross boundaries. Yeah. So they put effort into study it. To safeguard themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't about us, it was about them.
Yeah.
Now, they are studying it, right? We are still not, we have our scientists working on it, but not enough resources and efforts are being put in. Actually, most of the research that we are doing here is being funded
by
external funding.
Yeah.
So, again, my question is this, what is wrong with humans that, especially when the problem is staring right at them in the face, especially when the problem is there, because Ebola is back, it's killed more than it killed 5 years ago. Why can't we gather ourselves and go like, look, this is a problem. Our existence depends on this. However, whatever resource, in this case, well, money should not be an issue because we create money. So what prevents us from taking that crisis as something that's like a shared
responsibility
and say, okay, let us all come together and then, you know, find solutions to this.
Well, there are a couple of things that come to mind. On the issue of solving this problem, for example, like Ebola, like you were saying, if the people who are faced with this problem do not recognize it as a problem, rather as a curse from God, then you can understand why there's no invested interest in scientific study and research into finding cures for it. Rather, the efforts will be spent into praying about it. That's one thing. Then the other thing is also to say, even if they do recognize it as a real problem, how much funding can they bring to bear in terms of what they are doing in terms of research to understand? Because you see, science is not developed in a sense, or technology is not developed in a sense of solving one particular problem, as I'm sure we. A great deal of the progress that is made in maybe medical research comes totally from directions where people are pursuing other ideas and then they happen to chance upon the right technical tools to solve it. So I mean, the Ebola problem can be solved if our society in general were interested in bio like really interested in biological problems as in virus transmissions, how biological systems work in general, and had come up with techniques to study and investigate these ideas, then would have been solving a problem which is just a side issue, solvable. You get, but our society as a whole doesn't recognize it as a real problem. And even if they do recognize it as a real problem, they sometimes even think it is some other person's need to, some other person who is to solve it. And then there's other conspiracy theories that are spun about these things, as in, oh, these are all inventions of the white man to sweep some of all of us dead and stuff. They don't recognize the problem for what it truly is, and therefore can't bring enough resources to it. Then with Africans, there's always the excuse that we have other challenges, like poverty and other problems that we have.
How can it be poor when you are dead?
Yeah, I know. I mean, but like the people, you know, in essence, I don't know whether there's a good thing about the free market or a bad thing about the free market, but the fact that there's always going to be a select group of people who are going to produce a certain service and then all of us will be consumers means science will all it will always be done by a group of people who have the funding to actually pour in a great deal of money for a long period of time to find out so that we all can benefit from it.
So, I mean, it's going to be a hard argument for Africans itself that we need these things, although they are the ones who face these problems. But it's going to be hard when the people are deeply entrenched in certain conceptions of the world that makes it difficult.
Europe has always had a history with things like plagues.
Yeah.
So they know what it means. Because they've always explored other lands, and then when they came back, they brought in the illnesses from those lands, and then they've gone through many phases where a lot of the people, like close to 50% of their population, like that. So they know it as a real problem. Africans, I don't think, recognize these things as real problems. To the best of their knowledge, it's all myth, superstition, and even a sign that the world is coming to an end. So they would say, okay, fine, recognizing that this is a sign of the world is coming to an end, we'll try to avert it, the end of the world. So we'll say, okay, fine, we'll look forward to it. So it's hard for us to do something about it with our current conception of the world. That much is the case.
And on that depressing note, I'd like to thank...
Well, I hate to sound like a pessimist, but...
I told you.
This is a stark reality.
So now you understand my point. Like, there's reality, but then again, I get where your optimism comes from. That there's this silver lining that, oh, as long as we put effort into acquiring knowledge, we'll be able to change our present realities. So I get you. But then the reality is basically, it's a terrible outlook. It's a terrible outlook everywhere you look. I mean, one of the conversations that maybe we would have in the course of all of this is our imbibing of Western philosophy without recognizing the cultural context within which those philosophies were developed, and how or whether those philosophies would work with our cultural biases.
Yes, our cultural values.
Yes, exactly. And whether we are just copying blindly. We'll have that conversation during the course of this.
Well, I look forward to
this podcast. Right? All right. It was a pleasure having you here.
Same here.
Good. And as always, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
This has been the Hacktivist Podcast. As always, think for yourself and care for others.